Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney. I'm your host. I will be escorting you about a bit of the battle space of the war for the free world with some extraordinary guests. John Perdue will be joining us to talk a bit about what is happening in Latin America and the role that some of our adversaries elsewhere around the world are now playing in making our backyard, as some would have it, our front yard, as I think of it, a much more dangerous place. We'll be talking with him in segment two. Segment three, Stephen Hunter, one of our country's most acclaimed and successful and, I think, influential novelists, will be joining us to talk about his new book, Soft Target, something that we all ought to be thinking about, as it is what we have a lot of in this country, soft targets. We'll be getting into what's real and what's fiction with Stephen in segment three. And then Andy McCarthy will be joining us. We'll visit with Andy about the submission of our government in various ways to those who adhere to Sharia in matters great and small, and I'm afraid in ways that will probably redound very much to our detriment. That much, much more with Andy McCarthy in segment four. But first, I want to talk with you a little bit about how I think this submission business is manifesting itself overseas, namely with respect to the Egyptian elections, which have just resulted in a rout for the throngs whose springtime hopes for freedom are now facing, I'm afraid, the prospect of a nuclear winter at the hands of the Muslim Brotherhood and its fellow Salafists. It turns out that these Islamists have garnered perhaps as much as 60% of the seats in the next Egyptian parliament, and therefore secured the opportunity to shape the country's new constitution in line with their ambitions to impose this totalitarian doctrine of Sharia, which we'll be talking about throughout the program, nationwide, to the grave detriment of the people of Egypt, their neighbors in Israel, and I believe for us as well. Now, this fiasco was made predictable back in early February when President Obama announced that President Hosni Mubarak of Egypt, a longtime ally, relatively reliable ally, had to leave office at once. It was clear even then that the most organized, the most disciplined, and the most ruthless group would prevail under the circumstances in what would assuredly be a kind of chaotic electoral environment, featuring, as it has, mass demonstrations in the streets, demands for the interim government to be overthrown, the sacking of the Israeli embassy, the murder of Coptic Christians, and so on. Apart from the Egyptian military, it's clear, and has been basically since the founding of the Muslim Brotherhood back in 1928, that the most organized, most disciplined, and most ruthless group in Egypt is indeed the Brotherhood. Now, we're told that the Obama administration has spent perhaps as much as $200 million to help non-Islamist parties organize and compete in last week's elections in Egypt. If true, that simply adds insult to injury, because the money was wasted not only due to the inadequacies of the liberal and secular elements to whom we're told much of it was given, but because they were hopelessly outgunned by the Muslim Brotherhood, not least because Team Obama, in the person of Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, made a point in the run-up to the vote, of welcoming the Muslim Brotherhood's participation in the political dialogue, as she puts it, in Egypt. Now, in so doing, the Obama administration not only signaled that it could do business with the Brotherhood, it gave utter lie to any pretense of concern about the Islamists' role in, among other things, the massacre of those Copts, which I'm very pleased to say will be the subject of an important hearing tomorrow in the House of Representatives before the Tom Lantos Human Rights Commission. Now, the president and his subordinates seem absolutely determined to ignore the Muslim Brotherhood's various written affirmations of its agenda. Its creed, for example, which is supremacist and jihadist in the extreme. The strategic plan that was introduced in 1991 here in the United States by the Brotherhood's American arm, and the phased plan for realizing its goal of, quote, eliminating and destroying the Western civilization from within, unquote. Ironically, some of these documents were actually introduced into evidence, uncontested, by the way, when federal prosecutors were beginning the trial of the Holy Land Foundation, a group that was involved in money laundering and material support for terrorism, tried down in Dallas in 2008. Now, here's the rub. At the same time that the Obama administration is engaged in this kind of outreach to the Muslim Brotherhood overseas, it is reaching out to and empowering Muslim Brotherhood front groups as their exclusive interlocutors with Muslims inside the United States. In fact, incredible as it may seem, the Department of Homeland Security, as we'll be talking about with Andy McCarthy shortly, has promulgated guidelines that effectively require all trainers and their training material to be approved by, quote, community leaders, unquote, by which the Department of Homeland Security clearly means officials of organizations like the Islamic Society of North America and the Council on American-Islamic Relations, that in some of those documents that I just referred to, the U.S. government has been able to establish are tied to the Muslim Brotherhood. Now, I have to wonder, to what extent does this kind of myopia, blindness, willful blindness, if you will, reflect the influence that is being exercised on senior administration officials by people around them with deep ties to the Muslim Brotherhood? This may come as a shock to you. Indeed, it is shocking. But for example, and this is just one of many, Secretary of State Clinton's Deputy Chief of Staff, Huma Abedin, has a mother by the name of Saleha Abedin and a brother whose name is Hassan Abedin, who have been linked respectively to the Muslim Sisterhood and Brotherhood. The question inevitably must occur, could those ties of such well-placed individuals with clear influence on people like Mrs. Clinton be translating into her judgments, favorable as it proved to be, about having the Muslim Brotherhood come to power in Egypt, or about, say, the reliability of the Islamist government of our NATO ally, Turkey? We may also be seeing this influence shaping the meeting scheduled for next week between Mrs. Clinton and the Organization of the Islamic Conference, a meeting that is aimed at trying to end Islamophobia in this country by, it would appear, restricting expression that characterizes such Islamophobes, specifically expression that gives offense to Muslims. I must tell you, this is very troubling to me, and I fear not only what's been happening in Egypt, but what is happening in this country will lead to great peril if it is perceived, as I think it must be, as our submission to our enemies. We'll be talking more about that thought with Andy McCarthy by and by, but I'd like to know what you think about it. Get in touch with us at securefreedomradio.com or the Frank Gaffney Twitter or Facebook accounts. Next up, we'll be talking with John Perdue about how some of these Islamists are operating in the Western Hemisphere and what it means for you.
We want to know what you think. Leave your comments at 1-800-332-7131.
I was able to lose the 80 pounds I gained due to pregnancy. It was pretty easy. Eat whatever I wanted and not think about it.
The Meta System from Judy Singer has been helping make weight loss easier for a quarter century.
My husband's grandmother used it 20 years ago to lose weight for a wedding and said it was the only way to go.
The Meta System also has an excellent support staff.
They were very supportive. The first time that I ordered the product, they called me and suggested that I order a lower dosage to begin with. They didn't want me to jump the gun right off the bat, and it was nice to know that they actually cared.
And the weight loss is so dramatic, people wonder.
With the Meta System, I've got many questions about how I managed raising a baby and working full-time and lose the weight and eat whatever I wanted.
People who use it recommend it.
I suggested the Meta System to my mother, and she has lost 30 pounds.
Learn more about weight loss with Judy Singer's The Meta System by calling 800-711-JUDY, 800-711-JUDY. The Meta System from Judy Singer, the powerful all-natural way to lose weight, 800-711-JUDY.
The first step in winning a war is to know whom you're fighting. 9 years after 9/11, the U.S. security establishment has failed to tell us. The very words we need to describe the war are being outlawed. We went from the war on terror under Bush to the war on man-made disasters under Obama. Neither identifies the threat doctrine behind the aggression, Islamic Sharia law. That's why the Center for Security Policy assembled Team B, an independent group of national security professionals, including Bill Clinton's Director of Central Intelligence, James Woolsey. The result is a book that challenges the assumptions of the current administration and exposes the supremacist nature of Sharia and the jihad its adherents are obliged to engage in. This report names the names of those responsible and makes plain the mortal peril now posed to America's Constitution, our national security, and way of life. For more information, visit ShariaTheThreat.com or order your copy of Sharia, The Threat to America at Amazon.com.
Congress doesn't have a budget for 2011, but the GOP has proposed a budget for 2012, and Bill Bennett likes it.
Maybe it helps to have that 2012 in the background, people hearing and seeing Ryan and the Republicans saying we're serious about really cutting the budget.
As a backdrop
to this debate about 2011, people make the decision, well, Republicans seem much more serious about this.
Bill Bennett's Morning in America, weekday mornings from 6 to 9 on 1260 WRC. New choice, intelligent talk.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. We're joined by John Perdue. He is the Director of Latin American Programs at the Fund for American Studies and the author of a new book, shortly to be issued, I should say, almost fully cooked, War of All the People, The Nexus of Latin American Radicalism and Middle Eastern Terrorism. And John, it's that nexus that I was anxious to explore with you. Thank you very much for coming back on Secure Freedom Radio. Great to have you with us.
Good to be here.
Let's talk a little bit about the link between Hugo Chavez of Venezuela and Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, which seems to be at the heart of this nexus that you're talking about. Give us a sense of the extent of this link and what it translates into in terms of policy.
Well, I can give you some examples here that have taken place recently. If you remember, in April of 2010, when the Center for Security Policy did an event on Capitol Hill about Latin America and focused a little bit about this scenario, I mentioned the Pentagon report that had come out the day before that had mentioned the Quds Force that
right.
had been said to have been increasing its presence, so to speak, in Latin America, and especially in Venezuela. And we recently saw this, the sacking of the British embassy in Tehran. And, you know, it's claimed to be a spontaneous student uprising, but what it is either it's either IRGC, besieged militia, or Quds Force, and or a combination of the three. And what these what they're trying to do is basically be the last bulwark for any kind of insurrection of, amongst the population against the regime. And what this shows is that they're training Chavez's militia to do the same thing and to prevent any kind of uprising within Venezuela. And we've now got, with Chavez with cancer, there's four scenarios with an October 7th election coming up in 2012 that Chavez wins, Chavez loses, Chavez is incapacitated due to his cancer, or he succumbs to his cancer before the elections. And I think the most worrisome of those scenarios is if Chavez loses and refuses to give up power. And we've already heard from his top military commander that the Venezuelan military will not allow an opposition to take power even if they win the election.
John Perdue, let's come back to that in a moment. Let's just stay with me on this Iranian connection, because as you are aware, we are witnessing reports at the moment of the Iranian military adopting a more alert posture, a war footing, some have called it. We've seen the shoot down reportedly of a, or commandeering perhaps, of a stealth drone, a very sophisticated drone. It appears as though there's a ramping up of incipient hostilities in the Middle East. Do you anticipate that thanks to this connection between Iran and Ahmadinejad, and I guess Castro is in the mix as well, that we will see any lashing out on the part of the regime translate into hostilities and, or at least aggressive activities here in our hemisphere as well?
Well, one thing we need to remember is every report I've seen on this mentions Russia first, and Russia, as we think it go further and further into this type of step-by-step subversion of its own country, has built a very tight alliance with Hugo Chavez as well. And they're the first ones mentioned, besides China, about giving this technology, this stealth technology, or passing it around. And if it goes to Russia, you can be guaranteed that it'll go to Venezuela as well. How long it would take them to reverse engineer it is another question, but it's certainly that whole alliance is into information sharing as far as they can go with it. And Chavez has shown he's spending a lot of the oil largesse these days on Russian military technology and things just as mundane as AK-47 factories. So and if you remember that Chavez was the last holdout amongst even some of the biggest despots in the world. Chavez was the last to maintain support for Muammar Gaddafi, even when he was pulled out of the sewer hole.
Mm-hmm. We're speaking with John Perdue. He is the director of Latin American Programs at the Fund for American Studies, the author of a forthcoming book, War of All the People, The Nexus of Latin American Radicalism and Middle Eastern Terrorism. And John, one of the pieces of this puzzle that you focus on, I know in the new book, and you've been writing about, warning about for some time, is the development through Chavez's largesse in part and through training by the foreign legions of Iran of militia throughout the region, some of whom are being armed with these AK-47s, we believe. Tell us what role you see these forces playing, perhaps in the event of the demise of Hugo Chavez before his term is up, perhaps elsewhere in the region.
And this also ties into another tie to Iran. Even recently, Iran's top military commander, Ahmed Vahidi, was found in Bolivia and was asked to leave. And because he was on he actually has an Interpol red notice on him to be arrested on site in any airport internationally. But because he had a diplomatic passport, they couldn't do it. But he was there in Bolivia to preside at the opening of the Military Academy of ALBA, which is a a site dedicated strictly to training these Bolivian, these not just Bolivian, but militia from all of the Alba countries. This is civilian militia, and you've got Iran's top commander there. And there's stories have come out that Iran financed the building of this. And Vahidi, if you remember, was not only taught the initial training of the Quds Force, but was behind the bombing of the AMIA building in Buenos Aires in 1994. So he's been wanted by Argentina. So this is a major diplomatic tiff between the two countries as well.
John, the degree to which we see sort of a tinderbox here in our region and perhaps sparks being flicked into it by the Iranians, by Russia, as you say, perhaps even by China in their efforts to destabilize the region or maximize their influence in it at our expense. We have much to be concerned about, and we appreciate very much the work you do at the Fund for American Studies in monitoring and reporting on these things. Speak to us a little bit more about what you see coming in terms of the transition from Hugo Chavez, who is reliably reported to be in very poor health, and what might come next, and what most especially it might mean for not just the people of Venezuela and the immediate region, but for us as well.
For one thing, you've got inside the Venezuelan regime, you've got a power struggle that would initially ensue, and that looks like, so just from what we've seen so far, their initial reaction after Chavez was diagnosed and the word went international between his brother, Adán Chavez, and Rangel Silva, and Nicolas Maduro, who's another of his confidants. But what this does is there will be, if Chavez succumbed to his cancer in the next 6 months or prior to the election, you've got a power vacuum in Latin America, because you pull the rug out from under Cuba, for one thing, because they're being propped up by the oil largesse from Chavez as well, and all these Alba countries, which have depended upon the walking around money, as they say, that Chavez sends around in suitcases full of cash to Nicaragua, Ecuador, Bolivia. But you've got a major power vacuum that's going to take place, and it's not going to be good for stability. At least we know that much. And we've also said Fidel Castro is the one that has kind of led the intellectual basis for all these the step-by-step subversion they've taken of getting elected once and then never really having to leave office. Castro had told, for instance, in 2003, told Evo Morales of Bolivia, don't do what I did, don't have an armed uprising, but lead a democratic revolution like Chavez with a constituent assembly, and you just rig the constitution to allow you to stay in power. So all of that's going to come tumbling down in short order if Chavez is not reelected in 2012.
John Perdue, we have 1 minute left. So that being the case, the stakes being very high for a lot of very bad actors, is there any chance, in your estimation, that you'll see a transition to an alternative to Chavez, a democratic pro-Western alternative being tolerated by the army, by the Bolivarian militias, by Castro and his God only knows how many forces on the ground in Venezuela?
The key to this, Frank, is the student movement. If you see a good, organized, peaceful student movement that is able to march and able to galvanize forces, because it's one of the things that these militias are built for, is to make all the resistance to opposition, insurrection, not look like a military deployment. And that's the same that's been said for Iran as well as Venezuela. And if the student movement can do what they did several years ago and do a peaceful movement, I think you may get a successful transition. And the opposition candidates that are running against Chavez now are seeming to move that way as well.
Well, let's hope that the United States government will help such movements develop and take hold. John Perdue, thanks so much for joining us. It's always great to talk with you. Very important part of the world you cover, and we appreciate you sharing it with us. Next up, we'll be speaking with Stephen Hunter about his brand new, breathtakingly powerful book, Soft Target. Straight ahead.
Hey parents, finding it hard to communicate with kids in today's world of ever-changing slang?
Hi son.
Excuse me?
Introducing the Communicizer. Just strap non-toxic Communicizer to your mouth and go from boring old man speak.
Oh, you know, I'm here if you want to talk.
To 100% off the chain.
Text me whenever, yo.
It's that easy.
Thanks to Communicizer, I'm relevant to my kids again. I mean, a fly, boo.
And now when you buy Communicizer, you get the auto-tune attachment free. Sounds so hip-hop, your kids will want to talk to you for hours.
I used to have to walk 3 miles uphill to school every morning, shorty.
I love you, Dad.
I love you too, son.
Communicizer is not available in stores because it doesn't exist. But that's okay. You don't have to be perfect to be a perfect parent. Because kids in foster care don't need perfection. They need you. For more information on how you can adopt, go to AdoptUsKids.org. A public service announcement from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, Adopt Us Kids, and the Ad Council.
For decades, the Democratic Republic of Congo has endured economic collapse, poverty, and war. More than 3.5 million people have died in the conflict. Today, rebel forces continue to wreak havoc in the eastern Kivu provinces. The International Rescue Committee estimates that 30,000 children have been recruited as soldiers, and thousands more have lost their parents. Most of these children lack the most basic level of goods, security, and most especially, clean drinking water. Yet, there is a well of hope coming to eastern Congo in a village called Uvira. Washington, D.C.'s National Community Church is partnering with Global Outreach to bring a water pipeline to the Congo for Christ compound, an orphanage for children who have lost their parents to war and AIDS. Building a clean water source will sustain the school, provide for the children, and hundreds more in the village. Go to www.waterforcongo.com. Learn about the work of Global Outreach and give. You can be part of the community in Uvira, and like a well, you can be a source of hope in life. www.waterforcongo.com.
Hi, I'm Drew Brees, NFL quarterback for the New Orleans Saints, here with Bugs Bunny to remind you to get moving every day.
Because when you get moving an hour a day,
you fuel your body and your mind.
So what do you like to throw around the football like Drew?
Skateboard.
Play frisbee in the park.
Ride a bike.
Kick the soccer ball around.
Or dance in your room.
Just move it your way.
Because nothing makes you feel better than moving every day.
And that makes you part of a winning team.
So be a player.
You'll have more energy to do the things you like to do.
Move it your way and be a player.
Get up and play an hour a day, Doc. Check out how to be a player at letsmove.gov.
Head online to get tips on great ways to get moving every day.
That's right, at letsmove.gov. Let's hear that one more time, Doc. That's www.letsmove.gov. A message from the Ad Council and HHS.
I'll pick you up after school. Okay, I got it.
It's easy to take a day for granted. You and your family are connected by routine, and you stick to it. But what if a disaster strikes without warning? What if life as you know it has completely turned on its head? What if your day's routine is disrupted and you can't reach your family? Have you planned for that? Before a disaster turns your family's world upside down, it's up to you to be ready. Get a kit. Make a plan. Be informed. Today. Learn how at www.ready.gov. Ready.gov. This message brought to you by the Federal Emergency Management Agency and the Ad Council.
You're listening to Intelligent Talk on WRC 1260.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. We are joined, I am extraordinarily pleased to say, by Stephen Hunter, one of the preeminent novelists of our time, a man who cranks out thrillers faster than I can read them, quite frankly, but that's the kind of race I like to have. Stephen Hunter has just published Soft Target, a new thriller based upon a plot line that could be plucked from the day's news, and if not today's, certainly tomorrow's, and we want to visit with him both about the book and about that reality that it sheds some important light upon. Stephen Hunter, welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. What a treat to have you with us. Thank you, and congratulations.
Thank you very much, Frank.
On the new book.
Thank you, Frank. It's my pleasure.
Let's talk a little bit about the plot line, if you can share it with us without compromising sales. Soft Target is, of course, a term that I think probably most of us here are familiar with, but why don't you define it for us and describe how you get into a story about one of the most soft of targets in this country?
Well, to people who blow things up, there are two kinds of targets. There are hard targets, which are heavily defended, heavily bunkerized, heavily disguised and camouflaged and very difficult to take out, usually command and control centers, things like that. Then there are soft targets. Soft targets are basically the rest of us. That is to say, civilians, civilian installations, people who, you know, are worried about paying the mortgage and getting the right order at McDonald's and whether their kids are doing well in school, and they are huge targets of opportunity. And
soft targets are huge targets.
And in my book, they're collected at a place called America the Mall, which is a thin disguise version of the Great Mall in Minnesota, the Great American Mall. And one terrible Black Friday, 12 men with AK-74s show up and start shooting, and they drive a thousand, they kill a batch of people, and they drive a thousand people into the center of the mall, which, as you may or may not know, has a very vivid amusement park in there.
Yes, it does.
The book follows that crisis over 4 hours as various security forces attempt to deal with it as heroes and cowards and people who'd rather not be bothered all emerge it's a cinematic exercise basically in cross-cutting, and it takes you from episode to episode and crisis to crisis and gun battle to gun battle over a very small space in a very small time and with very urgent stakes.
You have written 17 novels, many of them top right bestsellers. You've received a Pulitzer Prize for your film criticism. You know your way around the written word, that's for sure, and it does move with great dispatch and I think with an authenticity which really I find particularly compelling, Stephen Hunter. You talk, if we may broaden the lens a little bit here and talk about the real world as well as the plot line. You talk about Somali gunmen, of which there is a large Somali population, of course, in Minnesota. We've had a number of them turning up in al-Shabaab in Somalia, waging jihad there. Yet, and I haven't gotten all the way through it, I confess, though I'm racing to do so, but I gather that the particular take on this particular group of Somalis in your novel is that they're not animated by Sharia, but working for somebody who may have other motivations. Can you get into that?
Well,
is that a real problem or not?
That's essentially it. However, the point I think is that Sharia makes them vulnerable to manipulation. They are so simple in their faith and so ignorant in their knowledge of the world and so committed to this 7th century creed called Islam that they are easily talked into doing outlandish and absurd and grotesque things, which seems to me to be very much the ethos of the child bomber. I mean, it's one of the salient features of extreme Islamic terrorism is that smart people convince dumb people to do really stupid acts which are extremely, among other things, self-destructive.
Yes, literally.
These poor peasants, excuse my I shouldn't say peasant. These poor agrarian proletariat have been, you know, sold a bill of goods, it seems to me. And in a sense, I feel, while I want them, if they're wrapped in dynamite, I want to put a sniper's bullet through their head. At the same time, they're kind of pathetically tragic in their innocence, in their belief, and in the stupidity with which they throw themselves into their own deaths as well as many other innocent people's deaths.
We're speaking with Stephen Hunter about his new book, Soft Target, a thriller, and indeed a thrilling thriller at that. I guess one of the questions that I have for you, Stephen, is this. It's often said to me, frankly, among others, when we lay out scenarios by which great harm could be done to our people. You're giving the enemy a roadmap. Your response to that?
Well, Yes and no. I mean, I don't think that I'm the first one to come up with this idea. I don't think I'm doing any strategic planning for Al-Qaeda. There are shopping malls and there are men willing to do great harm already in abundance in the world, and other people have seen that scenario and worried about that scenario. And my point here isn't to counsel the Al-Qaeda terrorists of the world, but it's to begin the discussion that I think we ought to have about the balance between civil liberties and security. And I just think this is really something that we've neglected to do. We've allowed ourselves on one side to romanticize the enemy and not see him as the enemy. And on the other side, I think we've demonized him too furiously. We need to have a conversation about where exactly freedom ends and security begins. And it's got to be a little bit more serious than, strip searching grandmothers in airports.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. And I guess for what it's worth, Stephen, my response to this is, look, the bad guys know all about this. In fact,
we
had an attack, as you know, in a Nebraska mall 2 years ago,
yes,
in which
exactly,
a number of people were killed by such an individual. Let me ask you this, Stephen. When we look at the various very soft targets in this country and the willingness of people either who really genuinely believe in Sharia and therefore believe it is their divine directed duty to go kill infidels like us, or whether it's because they're being manipulated by somebody else, as you posture in your book, what do you attribute the fact that we have had so few of these kinds of incidents to so far? That is, are we lucky? Is it good law enforcement or intelligence, or is it that the bad guys are biding their time for more of this in our future?
I think it's all of those things, but to me the most important things is that they're stupid. We've killed all the smart ones. Our drone program has been quite successful in hunting out the guys, the high IQ people with the capability of putting together the logistics and the timing and recruiting people with the will and the imagination and the willingness to do this. And the sort of the lone wolf terrorists that we've seen late have been characterized by their stupidity, which in a sense is, you know, a stupid guy is going to kill a lot of people. It hasn't happened yet, but it may very well happen in the next 4 minutes. And the reason is, and one of the unfortunate things that's happened is when these people do something stupid, like leave a bomb in a car with a fuse burning in Times Square, or try and detonate their shoe in an airplane, or set their underwear on fire, it's almost comic, and we take too much reassurance from it. I mean, this is the sort of thing where an infinite number of bombers trying an infinite number of stupid things are going to, sooner or later, do something extremely damaging and extremely serious and put us right back at 9/11. And it's going to seem as if the last 11 years and all the sacrifice and all the deaths in far and foreign cold places were worth nothing, because we've got a big pile of dead civilians.
Yeah. Stephen Harper, excuse me, 3-2-1. Stephen Hunter, thank you so much for this warning. I fear you're right about the inevitability of more attacks. I worry that you're wrong, that the folks that are perpetrating them are stupid, but we'll see. But thank you particularly for the counsel that you provide in this very provocative package of soft target for all of us to figure out what we need to do next to mitigate these dangers. Thank you, sir.
Right.
We'll be talking again soon, I hope. Next up, we'll be speaking with Andy McCarthy about submission to these terrorists and what form it may be taking in our U.S. government. Straight ahead.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
I went from a size 18 down to a size 5, and I was able to keep it off.
Angie had some serious challenges.
I had gone through a divorce and put on quite a bit of weight. There was an accident where I was put on a lot of medications, and I put on over 60 pounds. I tried every kind of diet, but diets just did not work.
Diets don't work is something they hear a lot over at The Metasystem from Judy Singer.
I heard heard about Judy Singer's Meta System, and I thought, well, you know, couldn't hurt to call. And I called them up, and they told me all about the product, and I thought, well, I'll give it a try. From the first week that I was on it, I wasn't hungry a lot, and it was just amazing. Jumping about 3 months ahead, I dropped 63 pounds.
If you're ready for a natural product that cleanses your system and helps you lose fat, talk to a Judy Singer counselor about the Meta System. Call 1-800-711-JUDY. 1-800-711-JUDY. The Meta System from Judy Singer. Powerful, all-natural weight loss. 1-800-711-JUDY.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the War of Ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
If your walls could talk, what would they say?
I have held the same mirror for 13 years.
I have been decorated with purple dinosaurs, baseball teams, and football helmets.
I have witnessed 33 Thanksgiving dinners. And one wedding proposal.
I have tiny notches marking the growth of three children.
I have caused a learning disability.
I am the reason that a fifth grader simply can't sit still.
I am responsible for a five-year-old's rage.
Just because you can't see lead paint doesn't mean it's not on walls, doors, windows, and sills. Today, lead paint poisoning affects over 1 million children. If your home is built before 1978, your family could be at risk. Let's make all kids lead-free kids. Log on to leadfreekids.org or call 800-424-LEAD.
I am the reason a child has trouble hearing.
If your walls could talk, what would they say?
Brought to you by the Coalition to End Childhood Lead Poisoning, EPA, HUD, and the Ad Council.
Is Nancy Pelosi looking to a higher power to get a balanced budget? Hugh Hewitt sets her straight.
When I hear you speak about this issue, of course, it's the Gospel of Matthew. When I was hungry, you gave me to eat and listen to
the Gospel. I just got to stop here. Nancy Pelosi quoting the Gospel of Matthew, as though that's got anything to do with the government. Let me just tell you, it doesn't.
Can I get an amen?
The Hugh Hewitt Show, weeknights from 6 to 9 on 1260 WRC. New choice, intelligent talk.
If you're a veteran of Iraq or Afghanistan, like me, coming home can be harder than expected. I felt a little out of place, but it turns out I wasn't alone.
At IAVA.org, there's a free online community of thousands of OIF and OEF vets who've got your back here, just like they did over there. So now, I'm never alone. I can get the resources I need, and talk to tons of people who understand where I'm coming from.
Whether it's navigating the GI Bill,
or VA hospitals,
managing the transition home, or meeting people you can share stories with,
you'll find it at IAVA.org. Even if it's just everyday stuff,
like getting tips on where to find a nice sweater for my dog.
Did he just say
sweater?
That?
Really?
What?
Okay, maybe not that, but everything else. No matter where you are, Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America is there for you. Join our community at IAVA.org.
We got your back.
Brought to you by Iraq-Afghanistan Veterans of America and the Ad Council.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. We are joined by Andy McCarthy, as we are each week. Andy is, of course, the author of Willful Blindness and the Grand Jihad, innumerable superb essays at National Review Online, and a featured guest of ours here at Secure Freedom Radio. Andy, I want to talk with you about submission by the United States. That, of course, being the literal meaning of the word Islam. We have training guidelines that are seemingly manifesting this phenomenon. An organization of Islamic conference meeting next week, which is, as best I can tell, all about that. And now a tremendously important institution, the U.S. International Religious Freedom Commission, that is being put out of business, as best I can tell, at the insistence of some of our foes in this fight. your thoughts on all of this and where it leaves us if we don't address it head on.
Well, Frank, I think this has been probably one of the main goals of the Islamist campaign that we've been up against for domestically for the better part of two decades now. Free expression, freedom of conscience are major targets of the Islamist movement. Free expression, our idea of it being the application of reason to the important issues of life, including an examination of Islam, frankly, and how it, how it is practiced and in various different places. That's something that they want to crack down on because there are obviously a number of abusive practices. We had a report just last week from U.S. Governed Afghanistan, or at least Afghanistan under the Constitution that the State Department helped write, where a 19-year-old woman is probably finally going to get out of jail because she's agreed to marry her rapist. She's serving a 19-year, she's serving a lengthy sentence for having
been raped.
Sex outside of marriage. That is the rape by one of her relatives. So, of course, she's the one who's in prison, not him. And they're going to let him. They're going to let her out because she's finally agreed to marry the guy who raped her. So that's what we're dealing with, and that's the kind of things they don't want us to be able to discuss.
Right. It certainly is evidence of Islamophobia, we're told endlessly, that one points this sort of thing out. And I appreciate enormously your efforts to do just that, Andy, despite the efforts to make all of us submit.
Right. If it's phobic to be concerned about that, then I'll plead guilty happily.
Yeah, I'm always concerned about such a concession because, of course, phobia, as I understand it, in the medical terminology, is unwarranted fear. And there's certainly nothing unwarranted about what they're trying to promote here in the way of our fearful submission. Speaking of all of that, Andy, let's talk a little bit about your postmortem, if I can use that term, on the Egyptian elections. I've written in my own column today about this as a predictable fiasco. You've done an even better job of dissecting it. How did we get to this point, and where do you think this leaves us in Egypt at the moment?
Well, we got to this point. There's two tracks for how you get to this point, Frank, because I don't want to overstate America's ability to control everything that happens in the world. I think that some things happen despite us. Nevertheless, sometimes we exacerbate a bad situation, as we have done by propitiating the Muslim Brotherhood, both its tentacles in the United States and its organizations overseas, in Egypt in particular. I think that only emboldened them and led to an acceleration of what we're seeing in Egypt, where the Brotherhood has very aggressively pushed for quick elections and succeeded in winning a referendum to that effect, knowing that quick elections would most likely empower them. We said before these elections took place, based on what we know about Egypt and what the referendum about the scheduling of the elections told us. If you remember, in that referendum, the fundamentalists defeated the secular Democrats by a whopping margin of about 4-1, 78-22%. I've been using 4 out of 5 as a mantra and telling people to expect to see a 4-1 margin in the ultimate elections. And what we're now seeing is the phase of the Egyptian elections are complicated, and they take place over a period of weeks in a number of phases. But the first phase included the cosmopolitan areas like Cairo and Alexandria, where in theory, if there really was a surge of secular Democrats, they would be strongest in those areas. What we're seeing now is that the fundamentalists wipe them out again. It's about 2/3 to 1/3. And when they're finished with the other phases of the election, which mainly occur in the hinterlands where the Islamists are even stronger, what you're going to find is the Muslim Brotherhood's been installed. It's actually being pulled in a more aggressive direction by the fact that even more rabid Islamist parties like the Noor Party are also capturing about 10 to 15% of the seats, which is going to put pressure on the Brotherhood as if they needed pressure to be even more aggressively Islamist. But what you'll find out at the end is it's about 4-1.
Yeah. Andy, I want to visit with you about that, the role of these so-called Salafists. You have, in one of your recent pieces, talked about airbrushing the Muslim Brotherhood by sort of touting the Salafists as something apart from them and making the Brotherhood, therefore, much more moderate. Do you really see a dime's worth of difference between these guys?
Well, I think I see a dime's worth of difference, Frank, only in the sense that we see a difference between, say, the Brotherhood and Al-Qaeda, which is also a fairly Salafist organization, but is much more aggressive and forcible in its tactics than the Brotherhood, which will use terrorism as an item on the menu, but has a much more sophisticated program of infiltration, I think. So in that sense, there's a difference perhaps in the crudity versus the sophistication of their tactics. But what I think people need to understand, and I think this is your essential point, if I may, the Brotherhood are Salafists. That's what they are. The Hassan al-Banna was a Salafist thinker. He's the founder of the Brotherhood. Saeed Qutb was a Salafist. Yusuf Karadawi is a Salafist. Those are the major important Brotherhood compasses, if you will. They are Salafists. What we're talking about here is a difference among Salafists, or a difference between Salafists in the tactics they use to Islamize a society. But to try to say that, one group of extreme fundamentalists is a Salafist and use that term in order to suggest that the Brotherhood aren't and that they're somehow more moderate is an absurd construct.
Yeah, and misleading to our great detriment. Andy McCarthy, let me segue from the dismal turnout of this democracy project in Egypt to the hysteria that you have been treating with your usual careful eye on the part of critics, notably Judge Napolitano of Fox News fame and Senator Rand Paul, concerning our civil liberties, which they consider to be in imminent peril as a result of a piece of legislation adopted by the Senate last week. Tell us about it.
Yeah, thanks, Frank. If somebody had told me going in, without telling you what the positions are, Rand Paul takes A position and John McCain and Lindsey Graham take B position, where do you think you'll be? I would have expected to be with Senator Paul, but if you look at what McCain and Graham and Carl Levin, who is the Democrat who's involved in this, if you look at the legislation they're trying to pass, which involves the treatment of enemy combatants, it doesn't change anything that we've been doing for 10 years. And I think, regrettably, both Judge Napolitano and Senator Paul have been essentially misrepresenting what they're trying to do as for the first time, turning all of America into a battlefield and locking up Americans willy-nilly, when in fact what the legislation actually says is that American citizens can be enemy combatants, which of course is how we've been treating them for 10 years, that enemy combatants, especially if they're foreign enemy combatants, should be held overseas and not brought to the United States for any purpose, including civilian trial, and that the preferred way to deal with enemy combatants except American citizens is to try them by military commission. There's a reading of the McCain-Levin bill that could be read to say you could put American citizens in military commissions, but when it's impossible because the only military commissions exist are the ones that Congress has authorized, and they don't have jurisdiction over Americans.
Andy, we have to let it go at that, but this is a rich subject. I look forward to more of the back and forth between you and Judge Napolitano and perhaps Rand Paul and others on this very important topic. I appreciate you spending some time with us on it here and look forward to talking with you about it again next week. And I look forward to talking with the rest of you tomorrow, same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.